In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, we're going to be discussing 7 catastrophically common launch mistakes. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 121. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What is the word this week, sir?
So I have suffered from a nerd injury.
You emailed me. You said, I think we need to push off the podcast by a day. And you said, I tripped over my headphone cable. And when I was getting up, I think it pulled something in my headphones.
The USB connector bent just when the cable got yanked. So I don't know. There's something in there where the Windows recognizes that it's connected to the machine and it sees exactly what kind of headphones it is. There's no sound coming out of it and the microphone doesn't work.
Well, so you bought new headphones and I bought a MacBook Air.
You want to trade?
Yeah, mine is. It's pretty beefy. It's got a 512 gig SSD drive and 8 gigs of RAM.
Actually, the extra space is really not that big a deal to me. Mine has a 256 gig SSD, and let's see here, I have half of it allocated for Windows, the other half allocated for OS X, and you know, I still have plenty of free space on it, so that's not a big deal. It's the 8 gigs of RAM would be nice to have, but I'd exchange that for a better screen anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm finally going Mac. I mean, partly because you've been able to pull it off well, and I know you do. You probably do a lot more Windows development than I do. I'm down now to just a very small amount of some .NET console apps that I maintain. Everything else I could do on a Mac with a good text editor. To be honest, there is no other hardware that I can find that anybody makes that runs Windows that is at all comparable to Mac hardware. It's just like crazy that no one has been able to catch up with them. But then I was playing with the MacBook Air and the Apple Store, and the gestures look really, I was just flipping around. I was like, wow, this is a nice OS. It's really impressed. So I'm going to give it a shot. But I look at Windows 8 and I've gotten on a couple machines with that on it. And I'm thinking, I know I can learn this, but why, if I'm going to go through a learning curve, I might as well just take the time now and jump to Mac.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, I think that the things that I would say about switching from regular Windows desktop to a MacBook Air is that if you want to run Windows on it too, just go with VMware Fusion. So it'll cost you like, you know, $50 or $100 or whatever to buy the software. And then in OS X, because it allows you to have virtual screens, you can have that full screen on another window, basically on a virtual screen, and you just three-finger swipe between operating systems, and it's completely seamless. And then the other thing that you'll probably have to do, because you're a Windows user and you're used to the function keys actually acting like function keys, you'll want to remap those so that you have to hold down control function, whatever the function is, to get to the OS X shortcuts. So like, for example, if you hit, there's one of them where you can turn the brightness up, or another one where you can turn the brightness down. But when you're in Windows, those things, typically you'll do like control F5 to compile in Visual Studio. That doesn't work. You have to hold down control function F5 in order to do it. So the key mappings are a little bit messed up. So I would advise switching over those key mappings so that you have to hold down the function key in order to get that top row to work in OS X.
Very nice. So that's what's going on in my world. How about you?
It's tax time. Somebody needs to just kill me.
Yeah, and you know, remember last year you said your tax date was March 15th?
Yep.
And I was like, mine's April 15th because I'm an LLC and you're a corp. And then my accountant gets in touch. He's like, I just filed an extension for you. So this year I'm trying not to do that. I'm actually going to try to file the LLC stuff on time on March 15th and then do the personal stuff by April 15th.
Mm-hmm. So what else you got going on?
Well, you know, this week we actually have two pretty cool stories, success stories from some micropreneurs. We have one is from Breck Palomo. He's a Lifetime Academy member, and he emailed me this week and he said, your academy got me started, and I now have a SaaS app. It's 3 years old that broke 6 figures last year, and it's tracking low 5 figures monthly for the last few months. I left my consulting business behind last October. That is really cool. This is why we do this. I love hearing stories like this. His URL is distressedpro.com. And the other congratulations I want to send out is to co-founder of Lightpoint Security. It's Zula Gonzalez. She's also a Lifetime Academy member. And Lightpoint Security was recognized as one of the top 10 most innovative security companies by RSA, the RSA conference, I guess, in 2013. And she said that they're going to be presenting at the RSA conference in February for a chance to win most innovative company. She also got into the launch festival with Jason Galkanis, but they got into a local Maryland startup festival that had like a higher prize and a higher possibility for them to win. So they bowed out of launch and they're doing the one in Maryland instead. But lots going on for them. So I just wanted to give both those guys a shout out. That company again was Lightpoint Security, and it's at lightpointsecurity.com. So congrats to both you guys.
You know, the only other thing I have is that I've been working on the documentation for Audit Shark, because I've been talking to people and they've looked at how Audit Shark works and they say it's great what it does, but I don't necessarily understand how to put anything together. So I've been working on the documentation a lot more to kind of help solve that problem. And writing documentation for a technical product that's, you know, when all the product documentation also is technical, is just a nightmare.
Yeah, it sure is. So are you doing that yourself?
Yeah. So I decided to just do it myself. You know, it's coming along. I mean, I've got a lot of the documentation out on the website, and then there's a development area where I've got more documentation that I'm kind of fine-tuning before I push it live to the website. But it's getting there.
Any news on the early access? Any changes? Are you still looking at a couple weeks to end it and go into launch?
No, I'm going to actually do one more round with some early access people. I want to identify about 8 people to send into this next round. And once I've identified those, I'll kind of turn them all loose at the same time and kind of see what they think, get some feedback from them. If there's anything that I can fix quickly, I will. Otherwise, I'll just kind of plow forward and push it out there and fix things as needed.
We're going to be talking about 7 catastrophically common launch mistakes. I feel like I've been saying the same thing for years. I guess I started blogging in 2005, that'd be 8 years, but I really started harping on the startup stuff and started learning and talking about these mistakes that I'd made, share insights about putting up landing pages and tracking key metrics and all this stuff. And yet at least a couple times a month, I either hear a podcast, I read a Hacker News story, I see something where people are making, they're still making these exact same mistakes. And I almost feel, I sent an email the other day to a colleague and I said, I feel like we're not moving forward. Like the industry is still making the same mistakes it has been for years. And like, I want us to push forward from that. Do you experience the same thing?
Yeah. And it's usually because you're being introduced to new people, or there's new people who are kind of coming into it. So 3 years ago, somebody who wasn't interested in doing a startup is now interested in doing one. And 3 years ago, there was this great idea about building a SaaS-based business and recurring revenue and all these things. And now they're getting into it and they're like, hey, did you hear about this new SaaS-based business and recurring revenue? And it's like, well, I heard about it 3 years ago, but you weren't here then. So you didn't hear the conversation.
Yeah. So I guess that's really what this episode is a collection of mistakes that I've heard basically within the last 2 weeks from a number of different blog posts, podcast discussions and other things. And some of these person actually called it out as like, I made this mistake. And other times they just said a quote that made me like smack myself in the head and say, oh man, how are you running a business? Like how, no wonder it failed. You know, a lot of these were postmortems on why they failed. And it's like, no wonder it failed. You made some basic fundamental mistakes. We're going to cover 7 mistakes. The first one is not putting up a landing page before you start coding. We talked a lot about putting up landing pages, and there's a number of different reasons for them. Even if you're not trying to test a market and do a smoke test and validate the idea, even if you're just going to charge in and code it anyways, not having a landing page is a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake. I will say it 10 more times. It is a huge mistake. You get so much information out of having a landing page up, because as you talk to people about it, whether it's on a podcast or whether it's at a conference or whether it's just one-on-one as you're talking to them about it, you can always say, hey, check out the landing page, and it gives you a little more info, and enter your email if you're interested. And so you get huge benefits from this. One, you get a short, even if it's a small list of emails, you have people who might be interested in beta testing the thing, and getting beta testers who are interested in your app, who are in the niche that you're serving, is a non-trivial task. So it's a really big deal. The other thing is it allows you to test verbiage and positioning and figure out where traffic is coming from, figure out which sources are converting. There's so much information you can get before you write a line of code or before you launch your app. I'm in the middle of this right now, and I'm realizing once again the intense value that you can get from a simple landing page and running some split tests and tracking who converts. I already have a much better picture of who my ultimate customer will be for Drip than I did 2 months ago before I had this landing page up.
I would add a lot to that, but I think that it leads a lot more into mistake number 2, which is not tracking key metrics from the start. And really, you start with that landing page, because not having a landing page is mistake number one. But mistake number two is not tracking the metrics for that landing page. If you're not figuring out who's coming to that landing page, what keywords they're clicking on to get there, how they're getting to the landing page, what words on the page are making them convert versus which ones are not. So if you're not doing A/B testing on there, that's another mistake. You have to be looking at these things and tracking the right data, because if you're not tracking the right things, then you're not ultimately going to be successful with it, because you don't know what's working and what's not.
Right. And you don't have to be a complete data analyst and not focus on building a really good product, right? You don't have to sit there and analyze data all the time and build your whole business and base it all on this data that's coming in. That's not what I'm talking about. What we're talking about is just getting a little more information about who's getting value and who's interested in your product. And especially early on in your product, this information is way, way more valuable than the money that a customer will give you. Because the money, even if it is a subscription, it's just a tiny little piece of this puzzle. Whereas getting more insight into who is actually using your app, that's a leverageable point, right? It's something that can open up entire new markets or entire new marketing approaches and ideas. And it just carries itself through. It's a flywheel on its own to learn that, hey, it's just so happens that women 20 to 40 years old are my key demographic, and they're the ones who this is really clicking with.
Yeah, I mean, if in any given case, if you could give away 10 subscriptions to whatever your product is in exchange for a 5% boost in revenue because you have boosted the conversion rate for that, hands down, no questions asked, go ahead and do it. Because in the long run, you're looking at that 5%. And on day one, yeah, 5% of $10 is 50 cents. But when you start looking at $1,000 or $10,000, I mean, that adds up very, very quickly. And that is repetitive and it accumulates over time.
Right. I heard a comment on a podcast where the guy said, I don't know where the traffic came from to our landing page, but I think it converted pretty well. And I was thinking to myself, how? Like, how did you do that? Because don't you realize that whatever traffic came there, that all of those sources are now, depending on how they convert into actual emails, those are your market. Like, those are the people you're now going to approach to write guest posts or to publish an infographic or to advertise on their blog or to just something, you know, just network with, because they are your people. If someone's blogging about designers and you built a tool for designers, then that's it. You know, if it converts, this is your market. And learning this stuff up front early on is just critical. So if you want specifics about what you should track, obviously throw Google Analytics on there. That's your first key. Next one is spend 2 minutes and set up a goal in Google Analytics so you can track which of the traffic sources actually convert into emails, like actually provide your email. And then beyond the landing page, because this whole thing about tracking metrics, it doesn't just apply to having a landing page. Once you get your marketing set up, you should track them as well. I track trial to paid conversion percentage. I track churn. Even if it's an approximation, even if you can't get an exact number, there are 5-10 different ways to calculate churn. Pick one. Even if you don't know it exactly, just pick one and go with it, because you'll notice the relative change over time. And when you look at your churn and it's catastrophically high, or 30% of your subscribers are leaving per month, you're going to know that you need to fix something. And if you're not measuring it, you just have no insight into that. And the last thing I would always look for is where conversions are coming from. I got to be honest, if you don't want to track metrics, if this whole discussion feels like a burden, it feels like something you don't want to do, then I genuinely think you should not be launching a product. I think that 1 out of 100 people who has success with a product don't track their metrics. And I think the other 99 look at this stuff that we're talking about, and that's how you build a true sustainable business.
You know, speaking of metrics, remember when we had the podcast where we were talking about pirate metrics?
Yep.
So Tyler Moore has a website called piratemetrics.com where he has a product that's designed to do a lot of what you just talked about. It's designed to measure acquisition, activation, retention, referral, and revenue. So if you hate doing metrics, then go sign up for that service and take a look at it. See if it's something that's going to meet your needs, and it can help you do some of that stuff.
Nice. It's a really cool site. Yeah, I agree. I think Pirate Metrics is a good option, and Kiss Metrics can be another one. It's a little more complicated. There's a lot to it. That's the thing, is people hear discussions about metrics and it's like it feels too complicated, and so they just don't do anything. Thing is, if you measure just 2 or 3 key metrics, you are 80 to 90% of the way there. And so take the advice and to go to piratemetrics.com.
And I think that's a good point. It's just measuring two or three, because you have to start somewhere. And until you start digging into those things and start really understanding what they mean for your business, then it's hard to figure out what other metrics you should be looking at. So starting out very small is probably better than starting out with a ton of metrics, because a ton of metrics is going to be overwhelming and you're not going to know what you should be looking at or what is important to pay attention to. Starting with just two or three metrics, you're going to have a good idea of what those numbers mean after a month or two. And then you're going to say, well, based on this information, I need to know that. How do I get it? And then you start building those additional things in. And over time, your metrics dashboard is going to grow to the point that it's going to support all of the different things that you need to figure out.
So mistake number three is assuming or saying that people are finding you through word of mouth. Because what this really means is, I don't know how people are finding us. And this ties in with not tracking metrics. But every time I've talked to a founder who tells me that their app is selling via word of mouth, and I've actually been able to go into their analytics, every time I found out that it's not word of mouth that's selling the app. Either they have something misconfigured with analytics that isn't showing refers. I've seen that happen. I've also seen people say, well, my direct traffic is growing and I can't explain why. And so it must just be people talking. It's word of mouth. The thing is if you have a SaaS app or any type of app where people come back to it to log in and you don't figure out a report and figure out a way to exclude those people, then your traffic is going to increase over time naturally. That's not word of mouth. That's just having 1,000 customers when you used to have 10. And your traffic is just a lot more. So word of mouth really is not as pervasive or as common as most people think. Most people think, I'm going to build a great product, great design, the app's going to work, and everybody's going to talk about it. Now, people telling each other by blogging about it or by tweeting about it or by saying it in some trackable form, because if they put it on a blog post and they link to you, then you're going to see that as a referrer. And that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about this when people say, oh, my direct traffic, and I have all this traffic coming in that I just can't describe. And so that must be word of mouth. That's the stuff I'm talking about. I think it's a dream of developers who think that marketing and sales are scammy, that just building an awesome product is going to be enough to do it. And the bottom line is, it usually is not in almost all cases. I'd say 1 out of 100 it is. And all of the other people actually know where their traffic's coming from, and they don't just assume it's word of mouth.
I think part of that's just a misinterpretation of the data by someone who's looking at it and saying, oh, well, I don't know where this traffic is coming from. It looks like it's direct, and most of it is direct, so it must be word of mouth. And then they parrot that out to other people, and people read it, and if you're not thinking about it in this way to understand that that's probably what's happening, and this original person just misinterpreted the data, and then that turns around and gets parroted out because, oh, well, they grew their business based on word of mouth. That's all I need to do. And that's kind of how that myth of by word of mouth gets started, and that's how it I guess continues to grow and be out there, because nobody will kill this myth because there's no definitive evidence to say, well, that didn't exist.
I heard someone who wants to be an indie developer, he's like a freelancer, but he was talking about how he didn't want to do marketing because it felt like marketing was scammy or something. And there are always these examples that are thrown around that are like, here's these companies that just, all they did was build great products, and they didn't market like everybody else. They just went and did their own thing and focused on the product. And examples thrown out are like Apple, Dropbox. There's a new app called Mailbox that has 700,000 people on an email list that's an iOS app. And I think Sparrow is another one. The thing is brilliant marketing is invisible. And all of these companies had world-class marketing and PR talent. They are machines, and they do it so well that you don't even see it. You're not seeing behind the curtain. They're so good at it that it's invisible to you. The fact that everyone is talking about it, quote unquote, is a carefully orchestrated and constructed PR and marketing campaign.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people compare what they want to do to like Apple and just say, oh, I just want to build a great product and people will love it and they'll tell all their friends about it. And it's just like, that is such a pipe dream. It just does not happen. I mean, there are certainly rare cases where it does, but by and large, that doesn't happen. And the chances of it happening to you are infinitesimally small. So mistake number four is running an open beta. And you really don't want to run an open beta because you want to be able to tightly control who is seeing things, and you want to be able to directly solicit feedback from people. Now, if you run a beta and you just open it up to the world, what happens is people will come in, they're going to sign up for it, and they may check it out, they may not, but chances are really good that they're not going to give you feedback, and they're not going to give you the feedback that you need because they're not vested in the product. You're not putting them through your marketing pipeline. You're not talking to them in the way that you would to a prospective customer, and therefore you're not pitching them on the product. So when they just sign up and just get dropped into your application. The problem is that they're just not seeing all of that stuff, so you don't get the feedback that you need in order to tweak it such that it's going to be effective when you get to the point where you start charging for people. And the second thing is charging people. You really want to charge people as early as you possibly can. You don't want to give accounts away free to people because you want them to pay for it to help validate your idea so that you can determine whether or not it's something that you need to continue with or whether you need to continue to refine your message until you find the pain point that people are having that they are willing to pay for.
Right. Imagine that you put yourself on a launch list. You're a potential customer of an app that you hear about in your email on a landing page. And 2 months later, you get a single email that's sent out to everyone. It says, hey, everyone, we just launched. Click here to get into our beta and give us feedback. You're very unlikely to do it. Whereas if instead you receive a personal email from the CEO that says, hey, so-and-so, addresses you by first name, or says, hey, you are on our launch list. It's a plain text email that obviously came directly from him. It's not a list, him or her. And they say, you know, hey, we've handpicked a handful out of our massive launch list, and we would love for you to come in, have a look at the app, and if you'd like to test it out, we'd love to have you do it. And that way, you're really getting to the people who have a dire need for your app, who have desire to actually give you real feedback. They're going to take the time to walk through it. And then, like Mike said, you can make the decision. You know, let's say you do let 5 beta testers in, and they give you really good feedback. Maybe you do comp them. You know, maybe you comp 5 people, but you don't comp your all 500 people on your list, because these are your best customers. These are the people who are most excited to hear about it. And they're the people who you spent months getting onto your email list, getting them to your landing page and getting them to sign up. So to basically just open up to everyone and then comp everyone, I didn't even realize people were doing this anymore, honestly, until I heard this a couple weeks ago. And I was like, no, you can't do this, because this is how to start on day one with zero revenue. You've worked all this time, you go through the launch, and then you basically just take your launch list and you throw it in the trash. Because yeah, you have 100 or 200 or 300 users, but now you're supporting them and you have no revenue. And people are actually happy to pay. If you provide them value, they will value the app more if you charge them something for it. And then this shows you can already start getting information about who's using it and why. And when people do cancel, you want to know that and you want to know why. And if it's a free plan and they just stop using it, you don't know if they would have canceled or not. It's just a much more opaque process to do this. It's not just about leaving money on the table, but it is about getting paid for your effort, to be honest. It's about starting off after all this work and getting at least a little bit of money that can help you bootstrap this app and grow it, because it's hard enough to get this thing off the ground without taking, you know, 4 months of your pre-launch marketing efforts and throwing them away. And mistake number 5 is launching with a single launch email. In an ideal world, you'll have at least 2 emails, and you can have up to 4, in my opinion. Your launch is an event. It's an event for you, and it's an event for people who are actually interested in your app. So imagine this, you're on a launch list, you haven't heard from anyone for 2 months, and suddenly you get this email and it's like, hey, Apptastic has launched and come and see our new app. Here's a link. I get these all the time and I don't remember what list I signed up for. I don't remember why I'm on this list. I don't even know if it's spam or if I actually did sign up for it. So that is epic fail. Do not do it. What you want to do is send out an email a week or two before your launch and tell the people right in the start, hey, you're receiving this email because you subscribed at this URL, and this is the product. This is probably why you subscribed, and this is the app, what it is and what it does, and build a little bit of anticipation. Either send a screenshot they haven't seen before, short screencast, send them a link to something they couldn't have access to before. And what this does is it starts building some anticipation with people who are actually interested in the app. If people aren't interested in the app, put right there at the top, if you don't want to hear any more about this, unsubscribe here and include a link and let them get off your list, because there will be a core group who's really excited about it, or there should be, or else you're not doing a very good job of, you know, vetting your product. But what this does is it starts getting you a little bit of data about, hey, who's clicking on this thing? How many people clicked on that? Are they interested in this app? And, you know, what can I do to engage with these people a little more? And so you email them a couple weeks beforehand, and then you can either email them the day of the launch or email them a couple days before and say, hey, everything's set and here's going to be the ultimate pricing and you're going to get a small discount for being on the list. Thanks a lot. You'll have a couple days to take advantage of that. And then, you know, you can send them an email the day that expires. So somewhere between 2 and 4 emails, but make it a little more of a process. It's like, you're not bothering people. You're not spamming people. They signed up for a list to hear about your app. Give them something to be excited about. This approach alone can seriously take you from closing 1% to 3% of your list up into the 15 or 20%. it can easily do that. At least getting people to try the app out. Maybe not full purchases, but it's just night and day.
So mistake number six is having a free plan. And unless you really know what you're doing, you do not want to have a free plan. And there's a bunch of different reasons for this. The first one is that it skews your metrics. It makes things way too complicated to try and figure out whether it's people who are on the free plan are canceling. And chances are good that those people are not going to cancel. So what's really going to happen is you're going to have this metric that shows you that your cancellation rate is only 2%, when the reality is that all the people who are on your free plan, they're not going to cancel anyway because it doesn't cost them anything. So now you've got this skewed percentage that in no way, shape, or form accurately reflects what your churn is going to be for that application. So, and unless you have experience and some very specific knowledge of how you're going to convert these free users into paid users, don't even bother. Rob, you said it best in the, was it the Wall Street Journal where you were quoted as saying free plans are like a samurai sword?
Yeah, it was New York Times. It was free plans are like a samurai sword. If you're a master, you can do amazing things with it. But if you're a beginner, you're more likely to cut your arm off. I really believe that. It's just what you've said. It's like having expertise in it. There are people who can use free plans to fantastic results. But it is way, way harder than it looks. You need to look behind the curtain and see how much experience those people have and precisely how they use that free plan. And it's very specific uses and very specific ways that they try to get people to convert from free to paid. There's all these things in place that if you don't do these things, you're just screwing up and you're just seeing the facade of how it works on the outside. The other thing is you need a good chunk of money to be able to outlast a free plan, because I've heard like Dropbox and Evernote, they convert X percent after a year of people using their app. So do you have the money to support all of those users for a year, you know, all those free users without getting revenue? If you don't, then in general, it's not a good idea. Mobile apps they're different, right? Having a free version with in-app purchases or having a light version, I've heard these things work very well. The free versions are not really a support burden with mobile apps like they are with web-based software. And in my opinion, they actually can work as a really good marketing channel, but that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, we really are talking about having a free tier, again, unless you know what you're doing. Or, I mean, even look at MailChimp. They didn't have a free tier when they launched. They got very big, and now they know their numbers, right? Inside and out, they know all of their metrics. They track everything. And now they introduce a free plan. Obviously, they have the knowledge and the expertise to be able to make that work. But on day one, when you're trying to launch, it's just too easy of an option for everyone to pick. And it's kind of akin to throwing your launch list in the trash, because you don't get people actually using the app and actually paying for it, which means they have to commit to it and actually commit to using it, and you know, which will ultimately make the app better because they give you feedback and they're more invested in it.
It can also be a distraction, especially when you're first launching, because you might start getting feedback from people, hey, I'd like it if it did this, or I'd like it if it did that, but these people aren't paying for it. So they're not seeing enough value in it to pay for it, yet you're going to accept advice from them. And that's really just not a good path to go down, because you're taking advice from people who have a vested interest in not paying for it. What you really need to concentrate on is those people who are paying for it. And by eliminating the free app or the free plan for your app, then you eliminate that possibility of bringing in that input from those types of people. And then down the road, as Rob said, like MailChimp did, once they got to a point where they knew what their numbers are, they were able to offer the free plan and measure it. And they've tweaked it several times over the past 18 months to try and figure out what's working, what's not, at what point will we be able to convert people into a paid version of the application.
Right. And I can name a number of people off the top of my head who have launched with free plans and who close them down or make them extremely hard to find within a few months of launching. Over and over, it's the same pattern. Launch with a free plan because, look, Dropbox did it. And then you wind up getting 600 users and no one converts and you don't know what to do and you don't have the time to figure it out or you don't have the experience to do it. And you just kind of bail on it. It's very common.
You know, I would add a mistake 6.1 to this, which is offering a low price plan, which is probably going to be more of a support burden than it's worth. And I've seen a lot of people where they'll launch a new product and they're like, well, you know, $10 or $20 a month seems right, but I'm going to have this $5 plan or an $8 plan because people, you know, have this mental hurdle about paying more than $10 for something. That's totally ridiculous. You really need to be charging people what the product is worth and what they're willing to pay, and not trying to get people to use the product and then in an effort to have them upgrade later. Offer them value up front. Make sure that it's going to be at a price point that's going to support you and the support burdens that you're going to undertake.
It is a usage-based thing where, like Dropbox, your usage naturally increases over time. And so as you use more space, then you would upgrade tiers. I could feasibly see having a low-price tier, but boy, if it's really, I would default to not doing that. You know, I would say that's the one time where you may consider doing it, is if someone is naturally, just through the use of the product, going to naturally upgrade to those higher tier things, and you will lose them otherwise if they're not going to sign up. Mistake number 7 is not growing fast enough. And I know probably what you're thinking hearing this, say, wait, Rob and Mike, they're not all about growth startups. The thing is, we're not, right? You can start a startup or start your app, launch your app and not grow it, and just grow it to a place where you're comfortable, and that's okay. It's not all about growth. The problem is that you need to grow your app fast enough to keep yourself interested in the project, or else you'll abandon it. The number one reason that bootstrap startups fail is because they don't make enough money to keep the person interested. Bottom line, not growing fast enough will kill your app, because you either get bored, other things come up. If you launch an app and it's making 10 grand a month by month two, you are much, much less likely to be bored with the thing than if you launch it and you're making $300 by month two.
Something else that factors into that is having the application be able to support all of the costs that it is essentially causing you. Because whenever you launch an application, typically you have to pay for hosting, you have to pay for any analytics services, all these other things that you're probably using to help promote the app and run your software and all the infrastructure that's in place, your bug tracking, your source control, everything else. It's going to cost you at least some money. And it's not to say you can't get open source solutions, but the fact of the matter is that your time is worth something. So you have to take those into consideration. And if it's not covering its cost, unless it's a real labor of love, you're going to find that it's very difficult to continue that for a long period of time.
So those are the 7 catastrophically common launch mistakes. Mistake number 1 is not putting up a landing page before you start coding. Mistake number 2 is not tracking key metrics from the start. Mistake number 3 is saying people are finding you through word of mouth. Mistake number 4 is running an open beta. Mistake number 5 is launching with a single launch email. Mistake number 6 is having a free plan. And mistake number 7 is not growing fast enough to keep yourself interested in the product.
If you have a question for us, you can call into our voice number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsofrestivus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsofrestivus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.